Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, dig it. Stop right on.
Well, good morning. Monday morning. This is Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. Earl's not going to be here this morning with us. Sam, how are you this morning?
I'm good, Sandy. How was your weekend?
Well, my weekend was all right. You know, on Fridays, you always say, thank God it's Friday. Well, do you celebrate Monday, or is this a day of mourning?
You know, it has nothing to do with you, but it's a little bittersweet today. Missed you, but... You know, the grind is not missed as much as you and Earl are.
Well, we'll miss Earl today. You know, I was thinking this morning, when you're working all through your working life, you wonder what it would be like to sit on the other side of the desk, you know, the side the boss sits on. And here I am, sitting on the other side of the desk.
Yes, in the hot seat today.
In the hot seat, yeah. And you know what? It doesn't feel much different, actually. It's sort of pretty much the same. You know, the weekend was filled with news, obviously, and this morning, you know, the news coming out of Tokyo with Biden there talking. You always never know quite what's going to come out of the president's mouth, regardless of who's the president. And this morning, apparently, we got some ambiguity added to our foreign policy. You know, our foreign policy with China has this interesting concept behind it. We have a one-China policy, but it's the label given to our policy is strategic ambiguity. So what the heck? You know, we've got an announced policy, and we announce that it's ambiguous. And our strategic ambiguity is that we have never recognized Taiwan as a country. We have indicated and agreed that we have a one-China policy, meaning that all of China, including Taiwan, is a part of the sovereign nation of China. And yet we have this Taiwanese situation in which many people want to wave their arms about and to think about it much like we think about now Ukraine. I was at an interesting event Friday night, frightening, in fact, it turned out. I've gone sort of annually, even like for 18 years, to something that celebrates Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt is claimed kind of by both parties. He's claimed by progressives. He's claimed by conservatives of being one of the great presidents in our past. And one of the things he was known for was his interest in the Navy and of his policies with respect to foreign policy. And with respect to foreign policy, it's pretty clearly recognized that Teddy Roosevelt was quite the hawk. He was very clear about the Monroe Doctrine and the fact that the United States had hegemony, I think, as we call the term, meaning that it had dominion over strategic influence over the Western Hemisphere. And so at this annual meeting, we get together, eat fine food, and pretend to be the people who are in control of the United States, I guess. And we had a speaker. We had a speaker who was an ex-naval officer and an author, a PhD, and he wanted to talk about the going forward policies of the United States, particularly as it related to our Navy and as it related to foreign policy. And holy cow, it was a scary event. He talked about how Taiwan was something that was going to be subjected to potential military action, and it was important that our military be prepared to make amphibious landings on Taiwan so that we could defend it with our troops. He talked about how he thought that the defense expenditures of our country, which currently measure about 3.7% of GDP, ought to go up to about 4.2 or 4.5%, which incidentally, people, is over $1 trillion a year that he was recommending. And it was just militant talk on top of militant talk, and the people in the audience all got sort of gung-ho about it, stood up and applauded at the end of his speech. I sat glumly in my chair wondering what in the world is going on. And I realized that what's been bothering me for so long bothers me even more today. And that is, Who makes these foreign policies? And who decides what it is that we announce to the world? And who is it that decides how much we spend of our national treasure every year? Is it rooms like I was sitting in with privileged people who are divorced from many realities, deciding that we ought to spend over $1 trillion a year on defense? And of course, spending $1 trillion a year on defense is going to suck money out of our budget that could otherwise be spent on other things. So a couple of weeks ago, I think I did the math on the radio, looking at a family with two income earners and three kids, earning $100,000 a year, and their three kids are 8 years old and under. And what would it be like in today's American economy to be that family? Well, we figured out very quickly, it didn't take a lot of high-level math, to figure out that that family was living paycheck to paycheck, that they were spending minimum, if they were honoring their obligation to get health insurance, spending a minimum of about $15,000 a year on health insurance, and that was before they had their copays or deductibles, that they were spending about $15,000 a year on health care, that they were spending about $20,000 a year on taxes, and that they were spending probably a minimum of about $36,000 a year on housing. Well, you do that math, and you don't have to be beyond third grade to understand that they have about $10,000 to $12,000 left for everything else, to save for college, to save for their retirement, to buy groceries, to pay utility bills. You can't get there from here. And these folks, incidentally, would be just fine if they lived in another country like, for instance, Germany or France, because in those countries they wouldn't have to save $15,000 a year of their income and spend it on child daycare, and they would have maternity leave, and they would have full-costed health care. They wouldn't have to be putting aside money for the education of their kids because their education would be free all the way up through the college level. And so what is it that we're doing in America to families who clearly would qualify as middle class? No one on this call would argue with the proposition listening right now would argue with the proposition that $100,000 a year qualifies as a middle income family. And yet we're asking our middle income families with our policies to live paycheck to paycheck. And one of those policies, one of the things that most drives that, is the fact that we're spending, well, in today's world, it was budgeted at $785 billion. We just authorized an additional $53 billion to be sent abroad to Ukraine. And we're now talking about spending no less than that sum of money on Taiwan, should Taiwan become the source of the same sort of controversy. And who is it that's setting our foreign policy? And why is it that we've decided to become totally arm's length from China and Russia, and we've decided to repartition the world into a Cold War? And how did that come about? Was it the result of our policies, or is it solely the result of the policies of these countries to which we're reacting? Or were they reacting to us and to the policies which we've been undertaking since about 2005? So I think part of this show needs to focus on the confluence of our foreign policies and the expenditures we're making on foreign policies, the relationship between Ukraine and Taiwan, and this middle-class family of $100,000, or even more importantly, the middle-class family that earns $60,000, or the more common family in our country that earns less than $60,000 a year. And these people aren't just living paycheck to paycheck. They're living desperately paycheck to paycheck in fear that someone in their family would get sick. Because if you earn $60,000 a year, you can't afford that $15,000 for health insurance, regardless of what the government is suggesting to you that you ought to be buying. And you can barely afford that daycare for your kid. In fact, it's likely that one of those folks who would otherwise, the income earners who would be earning income, stays home to take care of the kid and pushes the family into a poverty situation where you likely qualify for Badger Care in Wisconsin, at least, or qualify for Medicaid and even for public assistance. So what is our government doing? And why is it that we are willing to adopt profligately expensive foreign policies and to ignore the interests of our in our domestic interests of our families, the children in our country who deserve a birthright of an equal opportunity, who are being denied it? So we'll spend a while this morning talking about this. We'll also spend a brief while, talking about monkeypox. I think monkeypox are interesting mainly because of the humorous name, but, you know, we were talking sort of humorously about this situation that arose in China, Wuhan, the China virus, or the Wuhan virus, as it was called, until it suddenly emerged in our presence. Is monkeypox the next problem? Happily, it looks like it's responsive to existing vaccines, but it's always worrisome when across the world, someplace across the world, 100 people or 150 people come down with a mysterious illness that's contagious, and we start talking about it here, and our president says one day, well, we don't need to worry about it, and the next day says maybe we do. What about monkeypox? And actually, what about our existing problem, which is, the virus, the coronavirus that we're contending with now, is it coming back? You know, we have a new a warning that was issued last week by the government telling us that we should again be wearing masks indoors. So we've got that. And then I think the last hour we might focus on some troublesome things back here in the country and locally, which is educational policies and what's happening to our school boards. So we'll be back. We're taking a break now. We'll be back soon.